Juveniles in Hiding is a multimedia project aimed toward public education on the tragic reality of how sexual abuse occurs. As a practitioner who works with both offenders and victims, I hope that this multimedia project will provide knowledge for clinicians on how to listen ethically to first-person accounts of sexual abuse perpetration. Although controversial, sex offender rehabilitation is extremely important if we hope to prevent sexual abuse. Ricardo Martinez is a licensed psychologist with over 20 years of experience in working with sex offenders. He has been coaching me for the last 8 years in my work with juvenile sex offenders. And when it came to figuring out a way to help prepare people to listen to a sex offender's story, he was the first person that came to my mind. How would you coach someone to listen to an offender's story?
I think there's a couple of things that come to mind. One is, anybody listening to this podcast, let's say, to this line of study, somebody who's probably gone a long way into a career of helping others. And so this is not something that, you know, you're just going to run into on randomly on YouTube and just be a spectator to like all the other stuff that we see on WorldStar and other places like that. Like, and so if you've come this far, then what I think I would ask a person, whether it's a clinician or whether it's, you know, a clinician on my team or something like that, or somebody who's going to listen to your podcast, is I'd ask them to take the extra step and be a little bit of a scientist in listening to it. We all think that we kind of listen objectively and that we're good listeners, and we're really not. Like, the whole discipline of science has been developed because we're not objective listeners. We have a bias, we have a filter, we have agenda, we have all these different things. And so when somebody's listening to an offender, whether it's in a clinical setting, I think, or in this podcast, what I would ask them to do is to take a deep breath and to be like genuinely, genuinely curious and stupid and open to what they're going to hear next, so they can really get something out of it. The example that comes to mind is, so I take my kids a lot to the zoo. And there was one time that we were there in the baboon area where they have this big section. And I was there with my kids, and we were looking at the baboons as spectators. And there was a kid, but he was probably in his young 20s, who was probably a grad student. He had a clipboard and all these clickers, and he was like really recording behavior. And I was dying to go over and ask him, like, "Hey, what are you doing? What's your study on? What are you?" But he was like really looking at these baboons very, very different than I was, you know, or that my kids were. My kids were looking for them to be funny, maybe throw some feces around, like maybe bite each other. We were looking as total spectators at, you know, monkeys, so to speak, even though I think they're not monkeys. And he was looking at them through a completely different lens. He was totally open. He was looking at them like it was the first time he was seeing a baboon. So I think my advice is, when you meet somebody, and this probably extends more than just to sex offenders, I think when you have a client come in, you should approach it like this is the first client that you've ever had. And not tell yourself, well, my 5 o'clock is a depressed client. My 6 o'clock is a sex offender. Like, because then you come in with all these different preconceived notions and filters, and you don't really hear what the person's saying, or you miss a lot. And so with sex offenders in particular, given how much of a visceral response we have to them, I think listening, prepping yourself to be a scientist in the room, or an explorer, or you know, Jane Goodall, or whatever example there is of somebody who's really immersed themselves to understand something, whatever that is, whether it's, you know, you're a geologist and you're understanding rocks, or in our case, mental health workers, to really understand somebody who's committed a sex offense. And I think what people will find is that, you know, they're not monsters for the most part. That what they did is monstrous. I've worked with probably hundreds of sex offenders at this point, and I've really never been in the presence of a monster. And I think that that's a big deal. I don't think that's a coincidence. I've been in the presence of some people who did some really monstrous things, and each for a different reason or cause or etiology. But the impulse is to go in and say, like, wow, I'm going to listen to a monster. And I think that you may as well stuff cotton in your ears if that's how you're walking in. You don't need to listen if you're coming in with that type of preconceived notion.
So what is the science to listening to a sex offender story? What are some do's and don'ts in listening to a sex offender story?
I don't think that these do's and don'ts are sex offender specific. Like, I think it's science specific. So I think that, first of all, knowing your own biases, knowing your own stuff, knowing your own triggers, you know, having done your own work is important in this field in general, but especially with, you know, this area where people do what's arguably the worst thing that a human can do to another human being, you know, outside of killing them. And some people, you know, if you ask most men, would you rather die or would you rather be raped, most men will tell you, and partly because of their ego, that they'd rather be killed. And so this is arguably the worst thing that a human can do to another human being. And so so given that, I think that you need to really check your own stuff. And it doesn't mean you don't have it. It means you lay it out on the table and you know exactly what your stuff is. So I think that if you have your stuff in check, whatever that means, I think anybody doing clinical work has to have that in check. And then I think really refocusing on what the purpose is of you listening to it. You know, there's a little bit of a voyeurist in all of us. There's, you know, we all have bias, we all have expectations. But I think if you're aware of that, you can kind of, almost like a surgeon would have to, you know, wash his hands and you know, sterilize themselves before going into surgery.
What do you mean by voyeuristic? That someone could be listening to an offender story in a voyeuristic way?
We love car accidents. And that's we as a species. Like, nobody, you know, if you put a Ferrari on the side of the road, it will not cause gridlock. If you put two cars on the side of the road that bumped into each other, you get gridlock. Everybody has to look. And so we have a tendency to be attracted to not just novelty, but if it's a train wreck, even more so. And sex abuse is a train wreck. And so there can be a natural tendency to want to hear the story. I think we as clinicians are naturally curious. I think we want to know about other people, whether we can help them or not. We're interested in how people tick and how they think. And you want to be curious, but you don't want to be voyeuristic, you know. And I think the difference is voyeuristic is for me, and curious is for us or for you. And so, you know, to be naturally curious, like, I really want to understand how this person ticks. I want to be able to listen to this person and at the end of it say, like, I can see why they did what they did. I wouldn't do it, but I can see why they did what they did. You know, if you have those genetics and that family and that mentality and those beliefs and that access and that, you know, impulse control, I can see why this guy did what he did. And you can only get there if you start with, you know, a nice clean slate of genuine curiosity and a desire to want to understand.
What about the visceral response? How would you guide someone to manage their visceral response in a session or when they're listening to somebody's story?
That's a tougher one, because I feel like when I was a younger clinician, I did more to check my visceral response. I felt like I had to really control it. And I find that as I get older, and I don't know if this is a, you know, I could disguise it as a clinical skill. But I don't know if it's a clinical skill or me just not being that self-conscious, is that I tend to be more willing to share my visceral response with somebody, with a client. But I do so very, very therapeutically. Like, I will be very measured. If I hear something horrible, I am, at this point in my career, more likely to let them know that wow, that's really horrible. But I'm careful in my words to not give the impression that they are horrible or that they're rotten or that they're irredeemable or that they're not worth my time or my compassion. I guess maybe that's where the skill is. The skill might be to be able to say to somebody, like, what you did was really, really bad. And I still, you know, appreciate you as a human being, and I'm willing to work with you to make sure this never happens again.
is there harm that can be done in the way that you listen? Is there a potential for harm?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I think for everybody involved. I think there's harm that can be done to the clinician.
What way? How could a clinician be harmed by listening to an offender story?
Oh, I think hanging out with monsters is bad for you. And if you see people as monsters, then that's bad for you. Because you walk out of here having had, you know, an N of one experience with somebody who you saw as very bad and irredeemable and evil. And then you got to walk home with that. And so I think that can do you damage. Could do you damage in terms of your next client and your ability to do your work. It can do damage with you in terms of your, you know, your hope for the world and whether men are good or whether humans are good. And so it could do damage to the clinician, I think, if you don't. You know, in every other profession, you go through a process to go into work and you go through a process to come out of work. If you work in a factory, you put your uniform on, and then you get dirty, and then you walk out, and then you clean off before you go home. And so I think that, you know, looking at it, I don't look at my clients the same way I do when I hear about a sex offender on TV, or I'm home and I'm watching the news. My eye, my ear is different. I think it could do damage to the client, because if there's one factor that contributes to people doing bad things, either to themselves or to somebody else, it's shame. And here you are as a clinician asking this person to open up. They've trusted you enough to tell you the most horrible thing that they've done. You know, and I say this a lot. I say, you know, most people have not told somebody else the worst thing they've ever done or thought, right? And so you're asking this person to tell you the worst thing they've ever done, something that most of us haven't done. And they're trusting you with that for whatever reason. You know, maybe they have mixed motive, but they're trusting you with that, and you're going to return that by not helping them not do it again, or not by helping, let's say, the community not be victimized again. You're going to return that favor by shaming them. That makes them climb up. That makes them less likely to be helped by treatment in the future. That adds to the shame. I'd say it makes them, you know, more at risk. I don't know how much, but places them more at risk to have told their story once. It's no different than a kid who discloses sexual abuse and you tell them, I don't think it happened. Like, you just set that kid on a course that is a very different trajectory than if you would have said, I believe you. So I think it does damage on that side. And then it does damage to society as a whole. I think anytime we treat things with shame, we typically don't get good outcomes. Shame really doesn't work as a punishment. It doesn't really make anybody better. I mean, I haven't seen the research on anything that says that shame is a good thing. You know, guilt is a good thing. Feeling guilty provokes you to want to do better, to not do it again, to make amends, to fix it, to whatever. But I think shame just sticks you in the mud and says, you know, you are your behavior and you're irredeemable. You can't fix it. It's your identity now. And so what would be your motivation to do better? So I think it does damage on a bunch of different levels. You know, I shouldn't be doing surgery because I'm not trained and I don't have the mentality for it. And if you can't listen to this in a kind of open and scientific and, you know, to steal your word, ethical way, you shouldn't do it.
I met Mr. L in October 2016 at a meeting for the New Jersey Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, also known as NJATSA. He spoke on a panel with two other registered sex offenders about their rehabilitation and reintegration into the community. Yes, Mr. L is a registered sex offender. On the day of the panel, NJATSA stated that they had spent years attending monthly meetings discussing every aspect of sex offender rehabilitation from almost every perspective for the purposes of their training. However, this was the first meeting where they publicly included offenders in their training, first-person accounts. The CDC says that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused in their lifetime. So I would also like to include a trigger warning for those listening to this podcast who have personal histories of child sexual abuse. The content of this podcast may be difficult to hear as it contains details of sexual abuse perpetration. The following is Mr. L's story. Now, listening to Mr. L's story is difficult to say the least, and it's also not for the purposes of justifying his behavior, nor is it to shame him. But I wanted to share his story because I realized that so many people did not know what it was like to hear how a person commits a sexual offense in the very real way that I listen to it every day.
What happens is devastating. It's devastating not only to the victim and their family, but it's devastating on so many levels.
Right.
And like I know for myself, I wasn't aware of the impact that it was going to have. I wasn't aware of like the ripple effect. I knew what I was doing was wrong.
Yeah.
But at the same time, not thinking about the consequences. I was only thinking about the consequences of myself and thinking like, well, I'm going to go to prison for the rest of my life, you know, and I'm going to lose what I'm doing, which right. was like a feel good for me.
Yeah.
But not thinking about the impact that it was going to have on my victim and what was going to happen to him after the fact, how it was going to impact his family, how it was going to impact my family, how it was going to impact. And in therapy, like they tell us about like secondary victims. My
yeah.
primary victim is the person that I physically hurt.
Yes.
But emotionally, you know, it's a lot of people, especially, and you know, I was going to school, I was involved in projects at school, and I had to drop out of those projects. So that might be like minuscule compared to what I did to my victim, but it's still, it impacted so many people.
Yeah.
And I wasn't thinking about that at the time. And it took, you know, me going through 5 years of therapy to get to a point where it was like, holy shit, like, what did I do?
Right. So what can you tell me about what you did with, you know, as little and as much information as you feel comfortable? And if you'd like kind of give me I really want to know who you are. So like around how old you were, what was going on?
Sure.
Things like that.
So when I was 16 years old was when I first met my victim. I was working at a day camp and he was in my group.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 16, that was like right around the time where, and working at the camp, that I realized that I had an attraction to young boys. Before that, you know, I was struggling with being gay. And I mean, now I know that those are two separate things. But like I didn't know at that time. And my first instinct was to blame my attraction on these young boys to being gay. Like I mixed the two things up.
Okay.
And I just didn't know what to do. I wasn't telling anybody about being gay, so I certainly wasn't about to tell anybody about being attracted to young boys because I already knew that that was wrong. So I just didn't do anything about it, and I pretended like it wasn't going to be a problem, and I kept telling myself, like, you know, you're in control, you're not going to do anything, you know. And, you know, with that attitude, kept just making bad choices. Like, the adult thing to have done would have been to just, like, get myself out of the situation and go and talk to somebody about it, but I didn't do that because I was afraid. And also, on some level, like, it felt good to get attention from little kids. It felt good to be around them. But also just not knowing what I'm getting myself into. You know, and even before I was 16, I can think about like one instance. I think it was like a year or two before where I was on a field trip with one of my younger relatives, and there were two boys that said, you know, we'll show you ours if you show us yours. And I was 14 or 15 at the time, and I was like, no, you don't do that. So I had like the mental capacity to be like, no, that's, you don't do that. But it started like, I guess, like cogs turning in my head of like, well, you know, maybe they are interested. And it's just like it planted a seed in my head. So I meet my victim when I'm 16, and about 2 years later, just because of like living situations, I don't want to give too much information
away
because it might be too revealing. But so I was living in his home 2 years after I had already met him, and I lived in his home for the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And about halfway through the summer, I had taken him out, and you know, he had like a fun day, all that kind of stuff. And that night, at the suggestion of his mother, she said, why doesn't he go sleep downstairs with you? Because, and so before, like, he wasn't sleeping in my bed. And in that moment, it was like, well, I don't want to say no for multiple reasons. I don't want to say no because it might look suspicious if I say no. I know I have a problem. She doesn't know I have a problem. But because I know I have a problem, it might look suspicious if I say no. If I say no, I also know it's going to feel good. So that's another reason why I don't want to say no. So
it was almost like an opportunity.
It was an opportunity. So that night, I hadn't assaulted him that night, but I can tell you that it was very difficult to go to sleep because my mind was racing about doing something to him in that night. And then maybe 2 weeks later was the first time that I had assaulted him, and kind of like turning it into a game to manipulate him and thinking that it's fun and all that kind of stuff. And then that's the first time that I assaulted him, was that moment. And this was like one of the most, I mean, on top of physically assaulting him, but like really like emotionally scarring him in that moment was, his mother had called us upstairs and he tried to tell his family that I had done something to him, and I had made him out to be a liar in front of his entire family by saying, I don't know what he's talking about, I didn't do anything to him, I don't know why he would say that, and telling him like, it's not funny, you can't do that. And and then like right after that, like telling him I'm sorry, you know, like being very, very manipulative and really like confusing him and playing like both sides, splitting him from his family. And that was like the beginning of everything. And then anytime that I would go back to visit his home, it doesn't make it any better. I wouldn't assault him every time that I went back, but I still did it like more. And as time went on, the frequency, the amount of times that I would assault him got worse. And that's for just a number of factors. You know, as time went on, I know what I'm doing is wrong. Mm-hmm. But I have to make myself think that, you know, that it's not. So it sounds crazy, but like you make a story. And my story was that I was in love with my victim and he was in love with me, that we have this romantic relationship and this is part of the relationship. You know, relationships, you do sexual things to each other. So and that was like the story that I told myself. I know I would like. In therapy, it took me like a year and a half to really get out of that story that I was living in, because I didn't want to see myself as a monster. I didn't want to see myself as someone that was doing something wrong or someone that was hurting somebody. And because like I was really stuck there, like I really thought that I was in this romantic relationship. And then when I was in prison and going through therapy, I needed to hear very strong challenges from my peers, other sex offenders that had been going through therapy, and from the therapists. And it was necessary for them to say things like, my therapist, I'll never forget this moment, my and I mentioned it at ATSA, my therapist kind of just broke it down. She was like, Mr. L, you were 18 going into college, you were thinking about what college courses you were going to take, and your victim was 7 and he was losing his teeth. What kind of relationship was that? And when you hear it that way, obviously, to someone outside of that, it sounds pretty obvious. But to me, it was like, holy shit, you're right. Like, what did I do? Or another couple instances, and these came from my peers. One guy said, because I was in therapy, they tell you to say everything without, you know, holding back. I know I'm like holding back a little bit now because, it's, you know, people don't need to hear the graphic parts. But I was describing having my victim in my bed and like cuddling with him, things like that. And one peer said, yo, bro, you need to stop describing it that way. You were a grown-ass man with a little boy in your bed. There was no such thing as cuddling when you were doing that. And continuing to hear things like that helped me get out of that mind frame of that this was a romantic relationship. There was nothing romantic about it, and I can see that now. But I can tell you 6 years ago, I wasn't seeing it that way. Mm-hmm. And so going through therapy and hearing those things over and over again, you know, it definitely helped. It helped me get out of that mentality, helped me put things into perspective and really, you know, connect to, you know, the damage that I was talking about before. And not only the damage to my victim, but thinking about, like, you know, with his mom, I gained her trust and I shattered it. You know, she was very, and rightfully so, she was very upset with me, you know, and I didn't understand at the time, like, how impactful what I did was, because it's devastating. You know, she brought me into her home. She, you know, took care of me like I was her own son, and I, you know, I stepped all over that. And it was really fucked up. But at the time, again, like, I don't see it that way.
How did your family react to your sexual offense?
Obviously, my mom, very angry. A lot of, like, some of my family doesn't know. My direct family, like my parents, and I have a sibling, they were very angry with me. I think my mom, more so than anybody else, she just had this, like, picture of me of, like, being an upstanding guy, and I'm such a good boy, and all that kind of stuff. And that was my own doing, because I always presented like there was nothing wrong with me. I always presented like I was doing okay. I was getting good grades in school. I was doing what I needed to do. I had friends. And so it was like a shock. They, you know, my parents were just like, why didn't you tell us that anything was going on? Why didn't you ask for help? And when I was 16 years old, I wasn't thinking about telling anybody about anything. And I think that was what upset them the most, that I didn't go to them for help, and they couldn't understand why I didn't go to them for help. And they also, like, they felt guilty, like they felt like it was their fault that I did what I did, which is not true at all. I made my choices, and it had nothing to do with anything that they did. Today, my relationships with them are much better, more open. I don't think I can ever have such an open relationship, like where I would, like, I talk to my friends, you know. I just, you know, right now my parents are just more concerned that I'm okay, that I'm able to take care of myself, that I'm not getting in trouble. And they also, like, I think another piece of it was, you know, I'm a sex offender, and you see on the news all the time, like, there's a sex offender living over here, or this, a sex offender did this. And they're afraid of that. They're afraid that someone will find out and that I'll get in trouble, or I'll be on the news for whatever reason. And they don't want that, you know. They just want me to be okay. They want me to be able to live a happy and productive life, which is really reassuring, because I've seen so many instances where guys, you know, they commit a sex offense and they don't have anybody. So I've been really lucky to have the support that I've had from my family, not only my parents and my sibling, but also, you know, I have aunts and uncles who have been super supportive as well. You know, making sure that I transition into society well, if I need anything, you know, emotionally, financially, whatever I need, you know, they're there for me. And I've been really lucky to have that. I know other guys, you know, aren't so lucky.
What do you think has been most helpful in your rehabilitation?
The things that I learned in therapy, more than anything. You know, therapy wasn't only just about taking responsibility for what I did and understanding the impact that I had, but also learning how to be a productive human being, in terms of, you know, I was kind of just going with the flow earlier in life. I mean, I was a teenager, but it's still like, I didn't know how to have healthy relationships. I didn't really take care of myself. I had low self-esteem. I wasn't happy with the person that I was. And therapy really helped me embrace myself for who I am. I can't be perfect. There's no such thing as perfect. And that was what I was always chasing. I was chasing this idea of what it is to be perfect, like get the good grades, be the jock, get a good girlfriend, all that kind of stuff. But that was very contradictory to who I am as a person. I'm gay, and I don't have to get a good, I don't have to have like a super good career. I don't have to be a doctor or a lawyer. I don't have to have any of that stuff. And to just be happy with who I am, I have to accept that, you know, I'm gay, which I had a big problem with before, which I don't now. I'm proud to be gay. I'm proud to say it. I'm proud to, you know, meet guys and all that kind of stuff. I would never done that before going to prison. I was very closeted. And to know that, you know what, I have an attraction to young boys. It has nothing to do with my sexual orientation. Unfortunately, it's there. There's nothing I can do about it. But I can control it. Like, I don't have to entertain it. Before, when I had it mixed up with my sexual orientation, it felt like I have to entertain this as a part of it, and I have no other choice. And that was another thing I learned in therapy, is that I have choices, and every choice that I make has either positive consequences or negative consequences, and to think about what are those negative or positive consequences going to be. And you know, increasing my self-esteem, you know, feeling good about who I am, because when you don't feel good about who you are, you do stupid shit. And one of the, you know, things that you hear a lot in therapy is like, hurt people hurt people. So if I'm hurt, I'm going to hurt somebody else. And that's the last thing that I want to do, so I have to make sure that I don't go down that path anymore. And that's been very helpful today was, you know, anytime that I'm feeling down, you know, putting things into perspective. Like, you know, right now I have to remember that I just got out of prison in the beginning of the year. I'm not going to have a super career in 8 months, and to acknowledge the accomplishments that I've already had within the past 6 to 8 months. You know, I met my goal of going to the ATSA conference. I have a job. I have an apartment. I'm able to live on my own. I don't need the financial support of other people, and to commend myself for those things and to commend myself for what I've been able to do, even when things feel maybe like lonely or depressing or whatever it is, to always look for like the silver lining and things, to be positive about things. And with positive energy, I'll bring more positivity towards me as well.